From McMinnville, Oregon, this is Crisscrossing Science, the podcast that likes to put a positive spin on the standard model. I'm Michael Crosser, next to me is Chad Tilburg, and today's title is, It's Elementary, You Boson. Hey, Chad.
Who are you calling a boson? I'm more of a muon.
Well, muons are fermions. Yeah, you're right.
Of course, don't insult me.
Yeah. So today we're going to get into something called the standard model of elementary particles.
Yeah.
We've been sort of mulling this around for a bit. I keep procrastinating on doing this episode because there's a lot of stuff I don't want to get deep into the weeds. There's a lot of stuff that I don't totally understand because I'm not a particle physicist.
Uh-huh.
And so there are some nuances that I don't know.
Full disclosure, I'm not a particle physicist either.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So we're in the same boat as far as that goes.
Yep.
But it also happens that you can't really talk to particle physicists either. They're
insufferable. Is that what you're saying? Is that what you're saying, Michael Crosser?
They will call you a boson. Uh-huh. They'll just you boson. All right, so my thought here.
Yeah, hit me with it.
What I don't want to get into is what a lot of people fall into of like, this is so weird.
Oh.
Here's some crazy particles that do crazy things. And
okay.
What I want to get across is that it is odd in the sense that we don't see this every day. You have to have certain situations where you can even observe some of these things. But it fits into a general pattern. And and the tricky part here is that to find the answers, you can't just like look at it directly. Like you can't just like chip off a little piece and be like, ah, that makes sense. In order to kind of get into that, I think it's worthwhile to kind of think through other pieces of knowledge that we do know and kind of show like how we know other things about ourselves. Hopefully we can get to the story of like how we know about elementary particles more so than just being like, this is this type and this that type and just being a grocery list of all sorts of things.
Was that your particle physicist voice?
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
So, Chadwick.
Michael.
What would you say that we're made up of?
Stardust, man.
Oh, good call. Yes. That's a quote from Carl Sagan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's poetic.
It is poetic. And it is true, actually.
Well, there you go.
I mean, we could talk about that some other day.
Okay.
About how we're actually the byproducts of several other stars exploding.
Yeah. And then what those stars are making, presumably, is the elements.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yep.
Okay. And the elements are made up of protons, neutrons, electrons. Is that where we're getting at?
That is what we're getting at, yes.
Okay. All right.
So all of us are made up of these tiny little subunits. Huh. Well, we're actually made up of atoms. Let's start there.
Okay. All right. Yep.
The word atom is actually Greek for uncuttable.
Hmm.
So people had thought about this, like, could I just slice you in half and would you still be, at what point do you stop being you?
Uh-huh. It's hitting a little close to home, but is what you mean, though, sort of it's the smallest indivisible unit of something?
Yeah, right? And until only the last 100 years or so did we realize that there were things smaller than protons and neutrons.
And can you actually break apart protons, neutrons? Is that where we're going today?
Yes, you can break up protons and neutrons into smaller things, which are called quarks.
Oh.
And we'll get into that as well.
Okay.
But before we get into that, let's back it up some more. And so let's do a historical trek backwards. Uh-huh. The first scientists were people that we would not consider scientists now. Well, the first chemists were actually alchemists, were people who were trying to make gold out of lead.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that it was a fool's journey for them because, as we know now, lead and gold are both what we call elements.
All right.
And what they were trying to do is what we now call chemistry. When I think of chemistry, I'm thinking of basically I'm swapping out atoms with each other. Like certain atoms want to group together with other atoms.
Okay.
Like water, for instance, is the chemical name for that is H2O. Mm. We've got one oxygen atom and it likes to have two hydrogens stuck onto it. And it's very happy like that.
Okay. And that has something to do with the number of electrons involved and H2O being sort of at some sort of like stable point for those bonds of two hydrogens.
Yeah.
And
so,
then the complementary number of electrons that make up the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So let's talk about what's called the periodic table now.
Okay.
Which is sort of how chemists eventually started finding patterns in which elements like to stick together. Mm-hmm. And which elements like to switch around and partner up in different ways. And so you've seen a periodic table, I'm sure.
Yep.
There are these big tables with a whole bunch of numbers on them and letters on them. And they signify the lightest element is hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And then next to that is helium. And you have these different rows and columns that represent different things. And basically everything in one column behaves in a similar way.
Okay.
So basically, anything that's in the same column as hydrogen, which would be sodium, potassium, rubidium.
Lithium.
Other stuff.
Let's just name elements for half an hour.
These all will react with the same other types of elements in similar ways. Like you could basically have something like table salt is sodium chloride. I could take out the sodium and stick in a potassium, and potassium chloride is another type of a salt. But it behaves in a similar way as what NaCl does.
And so does this have something to do with like number of electrons and number of orbitals and how many of them are filled? And
exactly. That there's a certain number of electrons that, well, there are exactly as many electrons as there are protons in the nucleus.
Uh-huh.
So protons have a positive charge, electrons have a negative charge. And so you have to have the same number, otherwise it'll want to fix that situation. It's also true that the number of electrons you have, if you have a certain number, generally in the outer shell, it's a factor of 8, that if you have the right number in there, then it's perfectly happy. It won't react with anything. So for instance, like helium gas doesn't react with anything.
So that's that whole column over there, right?
Yeah, everything that's what we would call the noble gases.
Okay.
So like helium, neon, argon,
yep.
Those don't react with anything. And so it just happens that any element is happy to somehow have that number of electrons hanging around it.
Uh-huh.
But it can't do that really unless it's just kind of sharing some electrons. And so, for instance, if I have table salt, NaCl, sodium has one more charge than being one of these nice numbers.
So it's got like a surplus almost, an extra electron, and then like chloride, which is one column to the left of the noble gases.
Exactly.
Has like an empty spot.
And so those two are happy to get together, and then they're together, they're acting like they're a noble gas all of a sudden.
Okay.
And most chemical reactions behave in a similar way. Okay. That they're looking for certain partnerships based on how they fill certain things. And there's all these rules that we just find out. Like, we're like, okay, oh, this seems to like to react with that one.
And so that's chemistry.
Yeah, and so that's chemistry.
And so the sodium is still going to be sodium, and the chloride is still going to be chloride.
Yeah, all you're doing is you're swapping around this atom with this other atom. You're not actually changing the fundamental property of that atom.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting to get into that because those chemical reactions don't have the energy to actually change one element into another element.
Okay.
You need a lot more energy to do that. But it's also interesting that some of these elements are just not stable by themselves. Like they don't want to be by themselves. Like actually sodium, it loves to hook up with other things, but it doesn't by itself. It's very reactive and it'll quickly burn and do all sorts of other things. Same thing with a lot of other elements, like oxygen, for instance, doesn't want to be just by itself. The air that we breathe is O2 gas. It's two oxygen atoms that are stuck together.
Right.
And so generally speaking, it's actually very hard to isolate just to say this is oxygen just by itself.
Right.
Generally speaking, it wants to partner up with something else. And so to figure out the periodic table was actually a really good jigsaw puzzle. Like you had to really kind of figure things out to be like, okay, well, I know this reacts in this way and this other thing reacts in this other way. And so if we put all those things together, then you start finding the patterns.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not a simple problem of just being like, oh, look at this. I have oxygen.
Right.
You have to really play a lot of games to say like, this won't stand by itself, but it will behave with this one and with this other one and this other
right.
one. This is a great lead-in actually, because ultimately that's how I want to talk about the standard model of the elementary particles.
Oh, okay.
Because you cannot look at these are what we call subatomic particles because they're smaller than a proton and a neutron. And you can't just look at them just by themselves. You have to do some fancy footwork to see like, how can I combine them with other things and see what those rules are? And from that, kind of extract what the particles themselves are.
Okay.
And so that's kind of our story today.
Okay.
25 minutes into it.
Yeah, that's quite a prologue.
So let's actually get back at this energy question. So In order to swap atoms around, you have to use quite a bit of energy.
So you're talking chemical reactions?
This is still a chemical reaction.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But you know, it's about the level of energy of like burning a Bunsen burner or something like that. But if you want to change the element itself, you have to dig in there. You have to actually change how many protons are in the nucleus there.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to reach in there and affect that, you need a lot more energy. Mm-hmm. Because protons are like much more bound together than individual atoms are.
So like a really big Bunsen burner?
Exactly.
But like what order of magnitude larger or more energy are we talking here?
Well, so things like this might happen naturally in the sun.
Ah.
But you have to be at like a million Kelvin as opposed to a few hundred Kelvin.
Okay.
So significantly more energy required uh-huh. to do a lot of these things.
Okay.
Early chemists and stuff did not have the resources to get at that. Yeah. And it's only really been the last 100 years or so that we've even been able to do that.
Was the first inkling that this would be possible for one type of element to turn into a different type of element discovered along with radioactivity?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And so with like Marie Curie and all those, and then later on with the Manhattan Project, when they figured out how to make a bomb,
mm-hmm.
which is the marking of any great scientific achievement. Right. Mm-hmm. And when we do that in a lab or something, we can only do it on a small scale because it takes a lot of resources just to make a small, tiny amount of this stuff have enough energy to do it. Mm-hmm. And when I'm saying energy, I'm saying like it could just be heat, but that's sort of a random thermal motion. And so the way that particle physicists are able to get up to higher energies is they will actually intentionally smack things into each other. And you can kind of imagine how you might do this, that you might have an element, an atom or something like that, and through magnets or through charge plates or anything like that, you could actually get these elements to start to accelerate and start going faster and faster.
Okay. All right.
And you can imagine that if you go fast enough and you shoot it into a target of some sort, then you can get these nuclei to actually smack together and maybe insert some protons into this other one that you're shooting at. The first thing you might expect to have happen then is I might just be able to inject a few extra protons or neutrons into a nucleus and then change what that element is. And actually, this is how, looking back at the periodic table, there's a number of elements that are above like 100 in their atomic number. How many protons are there?
Yeah.
None of those happen in nature.
Yeah.
Those were all done in some of these facilities where they're speeding things up really, really fast and they're just smacking them with other elements.
And so they were detected and were they super short-lived?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. They all then broke apart shortly after and turned into something else. But they lived long enough that they could say, okay, oh, look, this had this much mass, this had this whatever. And
okay.
Now, you could actually go even faster than that if you had, instead of a stationary target, if you spun these others going faster the other direction and you hit them face on, that could be even more energy.
Okay. So if we have like a beam of, I don't know, protons or some other element or something, and you're accelerating them towards each other, and then you like bring these beams so they're facing head on to each other.
Yeah.
So crashing into each other. I get that these things are hitting each other and then ricocheting off.
Yep.
And so are they fusing together?
In some cases,
yeah. In some cases.
Yep.
And then other things are sort of like a car crash analogy, you know, like a mirror goes sailing off in one direction and it's kind of a morbid.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Morbid analogy, excuse me, but...
Yeah, you could make something bigger and then have other smaller bits kind of like, flying off in another direction.
Okay. And is it those smaller bits that are some of these weird things that you were talking about, like quarks or muons or...
Right.
That jazz?
Yeah, so it is possible to have actual elements coming out of that. It is possible to have things that are still elements that we would even recognize flying out of this whole thing. And it's not going to necessarily be a clean thing, right? Maybe you'll have like 1% is this thing that you're looking for and 99% of it is just other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to do even crazier stuff, you have to go at more and more energy, higher and higher energies. And you start seeing some more exotic things coming out of there.
Hmm.
These things that come out of there. So in our everyday lives and really in everything that we would ever care about, we're talking about protons, neutrons, electrons.
Mm-hmm.
Very little else does it matter to us at all. It is matter, but it's not important to us.
Well, yeah, it's out of our sensory range.
Yeah. But at these really high energies, then all sorts of extra crazy things start happening. And you have other subatomic particles that start being created and they're short-lived. But they have certain properties and you can measure them and all the things. I mean, I could tell you the names of these things, but they're just named after Greek letters. Okay. So it's like, oh, here's a sigma particle and here's a pion and here's this other thing. And so it's not an interesting thing for me to just list those off either.
Okay.
But again, it's a matter of trying to figure out like, okay, so now we're smacking things harder and harder and now we're seeing more and more these other subatomic particles and stuff like that.
And so is it the case that if you put together a certain blend of some of these subatomic particles, that equals a proton? And a certain other blend that equals a neutron?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, let's get our language right. So there are subatomic particles. And so from this point on, you know, we're talking about things that are smaller than an atom. So we'll call the next level down our subatomic particles.
And so a proton is an example of a subatomic particle.
Yes.
Okay.
But a proton is actually made up of even smaller things.
Hmm.
We will call those elementary particles.
Got it.
And an electron, for instance, is both. You can't break that down anymore.
Oh, really?
So it is both elementary and subatomic.
Okay.
Because that is the smallest unit that you can get.
Okay. Right? All right. Mm-hmm.
But while we're stuck here on terminology stuff, what all these studies eventually came to find is that there's something now that physicists call a standard model of subatomic particles. And broadly speaking, there are like three big categories within the standard model, each with some sub things within it.
Okay.
And we'll go one by one through each one. So hopefully we can keep track of all this stuff. But basically the three broad categories are things called baryons.
Okay.
And don't worry about the names. These names, sometimes they are meaningful to a physicist, but it's not worth talking about why it's meaningful.
Baryons were discovered by a guy named Barry.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. But other times, it's just a name. It's just a word.
Just a word.
One thing to know about a lot of these particles is that if you stick O-N at the end of it, then it suddenly becomes a thing. So, so like baryon. So the two other big categories are, so we got baryons. We have things called leptons.
Okay.
And we have things called field bosons.
As opposed to some other kind of boson?
Yeah, there are other kinds of bosons than just these field bosons.
Okay.
But we'll get to all of that later on.
Okay, I hope so.
Yeah. So, but these are the three broad categories that we're going to talk through.
Got it.
Okay. So these are strange things that we just don't see. But by doing enough of these experiments, you start seeing patterns with that as well.
Okay.
So just like with the periodic table, certain elements you could not see just oxygen all by itself.
Mm-hmm.
You would have oxygen gas, perhaps, but you'd have oxygen with hydrogen, or you'd have oxygen with carbon or oxygen with other stuff, because it always wants to partner up with something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so eventually they started finding that actually these particles, which we'll call baryons, which are protons and neutrons and stuff like that, they are actually all made up of something smaller, which began to be called a quark. And why is it called a quark? It was based off of some poem or something like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's no reason for it to be called a quark, except just someone was like, that's a cool word. Let's use that.
Okay. Well.
And so just like with the periodic table, we found that we have all these different types of elements that can be made, but they're all made up of the same stuff. They're all made up of protons and neutrons and electrons.
Okay.
In the same way, protons and neutrons and these lambdas and sigmas and whatnot are all made up of quarks.
So those are the things that when you put them together,
they will make,
up the protons and neutrons. Okay. How many different kinds of quarks are there?
There were only six types of quarks.
Okay. Are we sure about that? Or is there a model that
That's a good question.
We predict that, there ought to be six, and oh, there they are. Or is it just like we were counting and that's how many there are and who knows why?
Well, so it turns out that it should be an even number. They tend to group together. And so the first two quarks that were ever found are what protons and neutrons are made up of. And they were just given the name of up and down. So protons, I think, have two ups and one down, and neutron has two downs and one up.
Okay.
But then there are more exotic ones. For instance, heavier versions of up quarks are called strange, and their opposite are called charm.
That's cute.
And then the heavier ones than those, the last two to make the six, are top and bottom.
Okay.
So when I was first learning this stuff, they were called truth and beauty.
Oh.
And then someone was like, all right, you need to lay off the.
Yeah.
So they kind of simplified it, made it sound more something. I don't know.
T and B, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the quarks are all, they're up, down, strange, charm, and top and bottom.
Okay. And when you say they're a little bit heavier, I don't quite understand what you mean by that.
They just have more mass.
Here I feel like it's kind of, I'm losing my grip on it, because when I'm thinking about what gives something mass, I'm thinking in terms of like neutrons and protons.
Right.
And so what is it that gives these things their mass?
So let's hold off on that for just a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Because that, we'll start getting into the weeds there a little bit.
Oh, well, okay.
It's something that you have heard of if you've watched the news the last 10 years or so. We'll get to that. And so it turns out that protons and neutrons can be broken up into smaller things called quarks.
Uh-huh.
But it also turns out that electrons cannot. So electrons are a different type of thing.
Huh.
As a class, we call those leptons. But in general, there are six of those as well.
Whoa.
There are three of them that we talk about. There's electrons, muons, which you referenced, and tauons. And again, these names are not important. Muon is just the Greek letter mu. And they added a on to it to make it sound like a particle.
Okay.
And a tauon is the Greek letter tau.
Uh-huh.
And they threw on an on there.
Got it.
These are just like placeholder names that they're just like, I don't know, what should we call it? X? Okay, all right, let's call it that.
Yeah, an exon.
Yeah, which is actually a thing.
What is a positron, one of those leptons?
Yeah, so another thing that they have found is that it turns out there is an antiparticle to each of these particles. So there is such a thing as, so there's an up quark, but there's also an anti-up quark.
Shut the front door.
What's kind of wacky is that, so every elementary particle seems to have an antiparticle associated with it.
Okay.
And if you were to have a particle and an antiparticle collide, they just annihilate each other and release just a lot of energy. So it is true that there are anti particles of things.
Yeah.
And the way you know that they're anti is that they have the same mass as this fundamental particle, but an opposite charge.
Okay.
And so, for instance, a proton has a positive charge, but there's an antiproton, which has a negative charge.
So something with the equal mass to a proton, but a negative charge.
Correct.
Got it. Okay.
And you just mentioned positron.
Okay.
That is the opposite of an electron.
Okay.
So if an electron and a positron were to collide, they annihilate each other.
Okay.
Yeah. So I just said that there were six and six of these things. There's actually twice that because each of them has antiparticle component to them.
They're like their evil twin version, the version with the goatee.
Yeah, exactly. But what's interesting is that our universe, or at least our section of the universe, is almost entirely dominated by particles.
Okay.
The antiparticles are very rare, which is good because they would annihilate and we'd have nothing.
So theoretically, could you have a universe or a region of a universe that was constituted primarily of the antis and they would all like chemically bond in the same way? And
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I've read that people have tried to make like anti-hydrogen.
Uh-huh.
So you would have a positron going around an antiproton.
Okay.
Now, the issue with that, of course, is it's still not going to last long. At some point, it's going to run into other stuff and annihilate. But
where do photons fit into this? Do they?
Yes, they do. Huh. And so the standard model has, so we've talked about these quarks. Standard model has these leptons.
Mm-hmm.
And the standard model has these fields that they talk about, which is how the quarks and the leptons interact with each other and amongst each other. And so the fields are things that interact at a distance.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, some fields that we actually may know about, like there's a gravitational field.
Okay.
Right? So we know we're attracted to the Earth, but there's no like line directly connecting us to the Earth like that.
It's true. Yeah. I'm not tethered.
Right. And then like magnetic fields.
Okay.
And so you can imagine like two magnets, you get them close to each other. If they're pointed the right way, they'll actually just push each other away.
Okay.
But they're not actually touching. They don't have to actually touch. They'll still repel the other one.
And so these things that act at a distance are fields.
Yes.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
A lot of times it's easy for us to think of a field as a separate thing from these particles that we've been talking about.
Uh-huh.
But in other cases, sometimes it's useful just for mathematical, just for modeling it. It's easier to think about a lot of these things as an individual, like an interaction, a short interaction, as if it's acting like a particle, okay? But we're going to call these sort of quasi-particle things, we're going to call them field bosons.
I see where the field comes from then.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you can imagine maybe something closer in your line of work. You can imagine like we have some chemical reaction or something that emits a little bit of light.
Uh-huh.
And yeah. Then maybe that bit of light is now absorbed by something else.
Okay. Yeah.
We could model that as it's emitting this light. The light, by the way, we would call a photon.
Got it.
And so then maybe this one thing is emitting a photon, and then that photon is absorbed by something else. So, you know, it feels a little bit weird to call light a particle, but in many ways it's easy to model it that way.
Oh, okay.
And similarly, we have some other things. We have something called a strong force, and it has a similar particle to it as well.
What is that particle?
That particle, so the strong force is what basically keeps all the protons and neutrons in the nucleus themselves.
Right, okay.
Okay, and mm-hmm. It turns out it's all these protons are repelling each other. There's the same charge, so they're all pushing each other apart.
Uh-huh.
But this nuclear force is keeping the nucleus together. It's called the strong force because it's stronger than those.
Okay.
Uh-huh. So, you know.
Yep.
It makes sense.
Yep.
It's a logical name.
Yeah.
But, you know, I like to think of it as this is the glue for the nucleus.
Uh-huh.
And these are called gluons, by the way.
Okay. Wow.
It makes sense. What are the
chances? It does make sense. It all holds together. And people think this stuff is complicated.
I know. And then there are some other interactions that are called weak interactions. Because they're not as strong as the strong interactions.
I could have guessed. Could have guessed that. Yeah.
And so two of these other particles are called the weak interaction fields.
Okay. So I understand the idea of protons that are positively charged. There's this force that keeps them from flying apart from each other.
Yeah.
So then is there some way we can detect the manifestation of the weak force?
I don't think so. I think you can only detect the results of the weak force. But it's a tricky puzzle where you're looking at the effects of things, and it's very hard to find actual manifestations of the fields themselves.
Okay.
The final field was just actually experimentally discovered recently. When people were putting together all these interactions and stuff like that, again, what they're trying to find are patterns. They're trying to see if I combine this thing with this other thing, I should get a third thing. Can I predict that that's what I'm going to get? And they were finding a certain little anomalies here and there and that couldn't make any sense. And so then in the 1960s or so, a bunch of theorists actually came up with this, but the one who got famous for it was a guy named Peter Higgs. And he came up with this idea of like, well, what if we have this other boson, so another one of these fields, that interacts in this particular way?
Mm-hmm.
That eventually became known as the Higgs boson.
Okay.
And was just a theoretical concept for a long, long time.
So I feel like I've heard other stories about the development of theory in physics, about like Einstein having some constant that he thought had to be part
sure.
of an equation, and
yeah.
later he decided that he wished he hadn't put it in there. And
right.
is this another example of something that helped the math work out?
Right. I mean, they were trying to find patterns in general.
And help the pattern?
Yeah.
Like if it were real, then it would account for these patterns.
Right. And so this was just a theoretical thing saying like, well, if this existed, then these things would interact in a certain way, and mm-hmm. we would expect this.
Mm-hmm.
And it got more credence because over the years, more particles were discovered, and people predicted other particles, and they saw what they did see, and it all fit within the framework of all this stuff.
Yeah.
And then it was about, what, maybe 10 years ago now that there was a project at CERN. So to get at some of these questions, it all has to do with energy. Like, you have to have really, really high energy, meaning that things have to go super fast and smack each other super hard in order to see some of these effects. And so there are lots of colliders all over the place that are doing, like, making new elements and things like that. But the two biggest colliders are one's located just outside of Chicago called Fermi Lab, and one is located on the border between France and Switzerland, and that is called CERN.
Uh-huh.
And so they had a project specifically to find this Higgs boson. They were successful. They were able to actually find that it does in fact exist, and it behaves the way that they all were hoping it would and predicted that it would. So at the moment, the standard model is still standing, and it is still fitting everything that people see. Yeah, so this is a brief summary of what particle accelerators do.
Okay.
And the reason that both CERN and Fermilab will oftentimes shut down and rebuild for a year or two and then try to fire back up, because they're both trying to get to higher and higher energies. The more energetic these reactions are, the more the stuff you're able to find.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of a long-standing race between those two labs. At the very beginning of the Big Bang, energy was incredibly dense. Like, the entire universe was dense, which uh-huh. means that all the energy there was incredibly high. And very quickly, we expanded outward, and that energy kind of just spread out a little bit. So now we don't see these energies every day, but the higher and higher energies that you can get to, it's the closer and closer you're getting to what the Big Bang was.
Hmm. And so how do you get higher and higher energies? Just faster and faster?
Faster and faster. Yeah, baby.
And so
So then having the Higgs boson discovered
yeah.
reinforced the standard model. So it gave them confidence. Like, they were very worried that they could not find it leading up to that, because they tried several other times, but they didn't quite have the energy to actually see it yet.
So when they fire up something like CERN, and they're going to have two beams of particles that they're going to collide,
yeah.
what kinds of speeds are we talking about? What does this apparatus look like?
So the apparatus, both CERN and Fermilab,
uh-huh.
are giant rings.
Define giant.
So,
like meters, feet?
So it's a circle that's buried underground.
Okay.
And it's like a mile or two in diameter.
Oh.
Yeah. These are big tunnels.
So it's a circular tunnel.
So these are giant rings that are accelerating stuff. And they're going up to about like 90% the speed of light.
Okay. And so these particles, they're not just like in a straight laser beam or something. They're actually going round and round and round.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And each time they go around, it's sort of like every time you cross go, you collect $200 or whatever, you speed up a little bit more and more and more.
Oh, so they get another kick.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You can't get to 90% of the speed of light just in one kick. You have to just keep pushing on them.
And is this done, as you suggested, by some sort of magnetic field?
Yes.
That pushes on them?
Yep.
Okay.
Well, the magnetic field is definitely there to direct them to keep going in a circle.
Okay.
But then they also have magnets in place to also push them.
Okay.
Or at least electric pulses to push them.
Okay. So there's not somebody like on the side with like a little bicycle crank or something.
Well, that's to
like,
get it started.
Rear.
Yeah, you need that to get it started, and then it runs pretty well.
Okay.
But these are extremely sensitive experiments. I actually heard a guy talking about it from CERN and some of the corrections that they had to do. Like, for instance, they realized that the train system, there was a train that ran, the closest it would come was like several miles away. But they knew like they had to not collect data at the moment that the train would pass.
Oh.
Because it was close enough that they could detect it and it would mess up their data.
Just the slightest vibrations traveling through the ground.
And that's also why they're buried underground to protect from other vibrations and other things like that.
Okay.
Anyway, that's our talk. This episode was recorded in the KSLC studios on the beautiful campus of Linfield College. Rodeo Ortega wrote our theme music. If you have a burning question that you would love to have answered, email us at crisscrossingsci@gmail.com, all one word, all lowercase. Or contact us on Facebook, and we will be sure to include your questions in a later episode. If you like this episode or anything like it, subscribe to this podcast. While there, leave a comment and a rating, and that will help other people find our podcasts in the future. Until next time, thanks for listening.